life's been so sweet to me.
Welcome to On Mindfulness. On Mindfulness is a show of the Shasta Resilience Project offered here on KKRN Community Supported Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Brasilera. And as if you're a follower of the show, you've noticed that we interview a range of mindfulness practitioners and other people who bring or integrate mindfulness into their lives in different ways. Today, I have the great pleasure of introducing and speaking with Larry Olmsted, whom some of you may know from his work here in United Way. And today we're going to be talking about his book. So, Larry, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be on this show and to speak on the topic of mindfulness.
Yeah. So, as we always do, introduce yourself in whatever way you think is helpful for grounding our conversation.
Oh, sure. Well, I came to Redding, California about, now it's 10 years ago, to run the United Way of Northern California. My previous background was as a journalist, as a media executive, and as a human resources leader and executive. And all of those experiences brought me into a strong feeling about the topic for today, because one of the things I learned along the way as a corporate diversity officer for a media company was that mindfulness was a critical element of becoming becoming smart and skilled in the realm of diversity and inclusion. So that was a key part of my orientation. The other thing I found as a manager and a leader is that intentionality about what you do and a mindful spirit about how you interact with your employees and with your customers and with your partners and others was critical to success in that realm. And it is one of the topics for today, I think, is my new book, How to Be an Awesome Boss. And one of the things, the central theme of that book is you have to be intentional about it. You cannot think that you're going to be a great boss just because you are great. You actually have to practice your craft, the craft of leading people, in an intentional way.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to focus a lot on that intentionality piece because that is so central to the kind of mindfulness that we often talk about. But before we go there, what was your initial motivation in writing the book? And when did the idea first occur to you?
Wow, motivation. There were many things that motivated me. Let me talk about one little story, though, that I think illustrates why this book, I think, is important and why I wanted to write it. And it involves, I'll use a public case, which is a gentleman named Gerald Boyd, who was my boss at the New York Times. Now, I went to the New York Times way back when, 1993, 94, I think I worked there. The Times is a great institution that is based on who can create great journalism and how do we do it. What I learned working there was that they didn't spend a lot of time thinking about how do you manage the people who actually create that great journalism. They were just simply, we're great, right? And we hire great people and they do great things. And Gerald was one of those people. Gerald was the first African-American metro editor at the New York Times. He ultimately became the first African-American managing editor of the New York Times. The end of the story is that Gerald was swept out along with the executive editor and other leaders there in a scandal that involved an African-American reporter who had fabricated some of his stories. Mm. And it was sad because Gerald himself, of course, is a man of very high integrity. But he and the others got swept out, in my view, because they had really failed to institute a culture of good management and of good supervision. And what I saw coming up in the business as a young Black person was a lot of people of color and women being put into positions where they had responsibility, but the culture had not really prepared them for the role of actually supervising people and all that it took to do that well. They might have been good leaders, mm-hmm. but not necessarily knowing the mechanics of supervision or, in fact, the way to best motivate and vet people. So I thought that was sad, and not just for people of color and for women, but in fact, what we find in a lot of businesses and a lot of entities and a lot of endeavors is the same thing. Folks, the most important thing to me about being a manager is your leadership of people and your ability to motivate them, choose the right people, put them in the right place, and help them execute correctly. But it's the thing that most people being put into leadership positions know the least about and get the least amount of training on. So that's why I felt it was good to write this book. And I happened to work with a gentleman in my career, now passed, as is Gerald, rest their souls, but a gentleman named Rafael Gonzalez. And Rafael was a great, great executive coach, and he became a friend and mentor. And he and I worked together in a consulting business. And Rafael said, "Larry, you need to write this book. You've accumulated a whole lot of knowledge about this topic, and you have a point of view." Rafael passed away, I think it was in 2012. So you have an idea of how long it has taken me to get around to actually doing this. But now that I retired from United Way, I had some time, so I figured I'd put it together and dedicate it to Rafael.
Yeah. Well, I ask because I find that a lot of writers, there's a seed or some kind of nudge, and maybe it feels like the time's not right, or maybe personally there's so many things that you're juggling or that are urgent, that there's often a gap between, hey, this is the book I want to write, and when it comes to fruition.
Yeah.
And it also occurs to me, like you spoke about the culture, that those instances also occurred when the culture was probably not also ready to integrate a more diverse workforce in the same way that people attended to that later.
Right. I think that those statements definitely are true. I think in the case of my work at the Times, and I should quickly say that despite that shortcoming, the Times obviously is incredibly important in my view, well-run institution. But you know, the mechanics of managing people, here's an example, just a small one from the Times. I did my first 3 months there, and of course it's a probationary period as it is as many companies, and you get a little write up, you know, did you pass probation, and here's a little evaluation. And at my end of my 3 months, Gerald gave me something like two sentences, you know, like, you know, Larry's doing well, you know, and in a way it was, oh, well, that's cool. I'm still on board. But it, of course, misses any opportunity to promote your strengths or tell you to lean into your strengths, or this is one thing to look out for, Larry, or over the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to work on this. So it's an opportunity lost as opposed to, oh, something really bad. And I think one of the points of my book is there's a lot of opportunity out there working with people to excel, help them excel beyond the obvious, and that's a way to go. But definitely culture matters and timing matters, and there are situations where companies and managers simply might not have the time or bandwidth or resources to devote as much to the people management piece as they would like.
What, in your experience in all of these diverse environments, did you see were some of the most salient barriers?
I think barrier number one is the understanding that you have to put time and effort and thinking into how you supervise people. A lot of times people are promoted based on their previous performance in an operational sense.
Yes.
The problem is that people are very complex, and they are the most challenging thing. You know, if you give somebody a plan and a process, most of us can follow a plan and a process. But if you go to somebody and say, this person is coming to work, but she seems distracted, and her workload is her production has fallen off by 10 or 15% over the last few months. And she doesn't seem to get along with Joe, who is somebody she needs to get along with in order to succeed. Well, that's a different set of issues. And most of us aren't really trained or get a lot of practice in addressing those issues. What I would argue, and certainly what I've seen in my career, is that people who take that extra few seconds to be mindful about how do you deal with that have an advantage. Even if you don't have a lot of specific training or went to a lot of specific seminars, if you just take the time to step back and say, why is this lady distracted? What is the problem with her and Joe? How is that impacting the business, which is the number one thing in most organizations? Then you're already ahead of the game, even if you don't have a lot of managerial know-how, right? So I think that that's the number one barrier. I think the number two barrier is that all of us have things to do. I mean, our jobs are busy, and especially if you're a manager. And when you have things to do, you start deprioritizing things, especially those things you're not comfortable with. And I certainly have worked with managers who are excellent people, good leaders. They're like, oh, I don't know how comfortable I am having a tough conversation with someone, so I'm going to put that off. The bigger payoff actually is dealing with those people who are doing well. One of the, I'd say about 20, 25 years ago, when really led by the Gallup organization, the whole strengths movement came in with strength finders and all of that sort of thing. And making the very, very excellent point, which has been proven in my career throughout, that it's hard to help someone who just simply doesn't have a strength all of a sudden have it. Okay, so we have a lot of people who are, and I give an example in my book of someone who was very strong at a lot of things, but not strong at writing skills and not strong at spelling skills. And as somebody who was a former journalist, I was going nuts working with this person. But then I realized this person, to be successful in our organization, does not have to be strong at these skills. They're really great at other things. I want to lean on those things, and we'll just backfill behind on the writing skills. So that's, again, a level of consciousness and a level of mindfulness and intentionality that's needed in order to overcome what is really a basic human response. Because when you're a boss and you see somebody not doing something well, you're just inspired to try to correct that. And part of intentionality of being a good supervisor is saying, I think we need to let that one go. And let me put all that effort into making this what this person's really good at. Let me exploit that for the benefit of the organization.
If they've been promoted for being creative and now are expected to follow plans and processes, and that was not really their strength to begin with.
Right.
But that requires the questioning and the openness.
Right.
Rather than rushing in with judgment.
Right. Most of us have been exposed to the whole thing about promoted beyond your level of competence. And there's a few aspects of that. What I found in my career is almost everything is around fit. And in terms of the success of an individual in a job, we're all, you could get 100 people, they all are good at something. And 98 of them want to succeed in the company. They want the company to succeed. But if you have them in the wrong job, and there are some jobs that you should never put Larry Olmsted in, right? Right. But there are a lot of jobs where, yeah, Larry Olmsted is going to be the right man for this position. So I think as a manager and a leader, that to me is maybe the number one thing you're really thinking about in terms of how am I building my team. And one of the other things that happens is you select people for a team and they do a bang up job and they're still there, but now the mission maybe has changed. And you see this a lot in organizations with CEOs, for instance. They bring in a guy or a lady. This is the right person for the right time. 5 years later, this certain seems like this person's struggling. Well, no, they're the same person. It's just that the environment has changed, right? And look at what's happening in business now is AI and everything getting disrupted on an international scale and so forth and so on. The skills you needed in your company 10 years ago, now they're a little different. Treating people with respect, helping people grow, you know, because what we've described a dynamic situation. So what you want as a manager is to be somebody who yourself is growing and learning, and you're helping your people do the same thing. When you help someone grow, that's the thing they appreciate the most, and they will do anything they can to help you. If they know that you've got their back in terms of growing and developing. So there's just some basic principles. If you follow, you know, these, I list 10. If you follow these 10, you're going to be pretty much okay, even with everything swirling around you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to On Mindfulness on KKRN, and I'm in conversation with Larry Olmsted. So respect and dignity, those concepts and values are challenged in today's environment. You know, you also lead the Building Bridges initiative, and we had a period where we talked more openly about diversity, equity, inclusion, and the current administration, you know, federally, we've had all of those challenges that we've talked about on this show. And so many examples in social media of people normalizing, not treating people with respect and dignity. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you see coaching people to come back to those values.
There are many people who see the examples being set at the very top of our government as an example, and not just the president, but actually now throughout government. If you watch any congressional hearings on C-SPAN or whatever, you're just going to be appalled at the lack of respect and dignity that is coming from the dais and coming from the floor. And you get people thinking, I'm incentivized to be boorish. I'm incentivized to insult. I'm incentivized to disregard whole groups. I'm incentivized to lie about Haitians eating pets. You know, I mean, it's incredible. And we see, so yes, that's going on. And I think my coaching is really would be around what's happening in your institution and what is going to drive success in your institution. You know, I have, as a consultant, as an example, present day and past day, experienced situations where an executive is dealing with people in their organization, for instance, who are not practicing, who are not respectful in their behavior, and you want to point them to the operational challenges that creates, okay? And frankly, even in our current federal administration, where you see the same kind of lack of respect and that behavior, they may not acknowledge all the time the operational difficulties it's creating, but it sure is creating a bunch of them,
sure.
Right? Up to and including, if you want to extrapolate on it, you know, $6 a gallon gasoline, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point would be to help people see the operational issues. And one of the things about business, whether it's a business of education or nonprofits or, you know, making widgets, is that as a manager, you always want to be mindful of the operational performance issues. And it's the easiest thing to draw your employees or your other stakeholders back to, right? So to me, in coaching, you say, well, because you did not treat this person with respect and dignity, because you were not inclusive in bringing the right people into the mix at the table, you ended up with this outcome for the organization that was not the outcome you were seeking. And one thing I always coach managers is that that's the first place you go back to. What is the impact on the organization based on the policy or the behavior that you've had? And Sharon, the last point about inclusiveness, I mentioned this anecdote in my book. As a young manager, I was running the city desk of the Detroit Free Press. They decided to renovate the building. And in the plans to renovate the building, they turned one of the women's bathrooms in my area into a storage closet, or they proposed to do that. And so they send the plans to me, and I'm like, you know, this is like administrative beneath me, right? So I look at the plan, I said, looks okay, boom. And but when my my sub editors looked at the plan, most of them were women, and they were like, ah, how could they do that? How could they? And so they came to me, and I passed that up to the publisher's office, and the publisher's office is like, well, we have, we're supposed to have X 0.3 numbers of bathrooms per, you know, 20 employees, and we're good. And I didn't settle for that. So we pushed and we got them to reverse their decision. And one of the things I came out of that with is that I needed to have involved these women in the process in the first place. The company needed to involve these people in the first. They need to have the right people sitting at the table making this decision so that the decision would be better, yeah. Right? And so that's just a small example of the importance of getting of inclusion. And to have a mindset that says, no, I'm not discriminatory. What help is it serving the United States of America to kick out 20, 30 people with 20, 30 years of soldiering experience who have proven themselves, you know, in their leadership in the battlefield just because they might be trans or they might be black or they might be female? Or that's nuts. And so... to me, running a successful organization means, again, about fit. Hey, who do we need to have in the room, and what do they need to be bringing in order for us to get the right outcomes?
The other aspect of that really struck me talking to some other, you know, local leaders over time is you created a culture where people would come to you. And,
yes.
And that's one of the things that we see, you know, nationally, but in other organizations too, that you can say you want inclusion or ideas, but if you haven't created a culture where people can come to your office and, hey, we need to tell you this is wrong, or you made a bad mistake, or they can say it in a lot of softer ways, but pushing back to make the organization better in contribution to this larger vision, it's a much harder road to hoe.
I think that that's correct. And I think that people are, let's put it this way. When you have an inclusive mindset, you're correct. You don't need special programs and, you know, EEO and this and that. folks will understand. We saw this certainly at United Way of Northern California. The North State is you know, I think probably Shasta County's population is something like about 80% Anglo. So, you know, you don't always have the ethnically diverse hiring pool that you might have in some bigger cities. But yet we had no trouble attracting people of color and women and people who, you know, LGBTQ, whatever, to our organization, because we didn't have to have a certain program. They simply understood by the way we operated, by the way we collaborated, by the way we, the kinds of programs that we were doing, the kind of way we would speak to people and engage with people, that, oh, this is a place where I think I'm going to feel comfortable. This is a place where I don't think they're going to judge me based on the color of my skin. You know, you have to look inward. Who am I? What am I projecting? Who is my organization? What are we projecting? Don't need an extra program. We just need to be authentic, real, respectful, inclusive. Every organization, you know, you've probably been through this, I'm sure, a dozen times. Oh, we have to create a mission statement, right? Mm-hmm. And a value statement and so forth and so on. In fact, having clarity on what those things are is important and does need to take some real reflection. Mm-hmm. Because once you are sure of what you stand for, then everybody else can be sure about what you stand for, right? And so it's important to have those kinds of statements, if you will, but also really important to live them.
Reflect on
and
them.
To live them each day. And that's why I would tell managers, everything you do and every action you take, connect it to those values, connect it to those mission, connect it to those principles so that your employees understand it. I'm asking you to do this. Why? Because it will help us live out this value. It'll help us execute on this mission that we've laid out. And I think what happens in the workplace often for managers is that they're like, oh, I've been told to do this by somebody, so I'm going to tell you to do it.
And you bring up too, like, and by the way, you should be living those values as well.
Yes.
Part of being an awesome boss is leading by example as well, that you demonstrate your commitment.
Oh, absolutely. And the book and just in general life, people know, all of us can think of examples where someone is telling you to do something, but they're not following through. They're not living it out. Or conversely, and one of the points I make in the book is that if you're a supervisor, everything you do is being looked at by employees. One of the things I learned is that my most casual encounter with an employee, hey, Sharon, how you doing today? Yeah, good. If I walk past Sharon and I don't say, hey, Sharon, how you doing? Sharon's going to spend the whole day, ooh, did I do something wrong? Am I on Larry's bad side? Oh, is he's upset. He fell out of bed the wrong side today. You know, right. To me, it's like a casual encounter. For Sharon, it's going to be, you know, a significant event. So you're being watched every step of the way as an as a manager. You can be intimidated by that, but what you really should do is leverage that, use that, okay, to model the kind of behavior that you want. You know, what we talked about culture. I worked for in Knight Ridder, which no longer exists, a media company, national media company, and the culture was very, very strong, set at the top. Respectful, mindful, polite behavior. Okay. And everybody who worked for that company, I mean, you know, you always have a few, whatever. People were good human beings. Because that's who the company attracted. People were ethical human beings because that's what the company preached. It just permeated through the culture and it started at the top. And yes, at the top said, be polite and be respectful, but wasn't, then that culture wouldn't have existed in that way.
It's hard to be authentic is one of the things I came away thinking if you're not intentional about why and how am I showing up. So if I'm asking Sharon how she's doing, I am really asking and I want to know.
Absolutely. You'll recall the book starts with a prologue talking about the guy who was the CEO of Knight Ridder, a guy named Jim Batten. And I mentioned the story that when people were hired onto the corporate staff, Jim had the security staff send up their security photos, right? So he could put the photo with the name so that when he passed them in the hallway, he would know what their names were, right? And so it didn't matter, you're the new receptionist or you're the new HR analyst or finance analyst, and you're somebody working in a cubbyhole and you might be on your way to restroom. And Mr. Batten would say, James, how are you doing? You started here about 3 weeks ago. Is everything going okay? And how's your kids? And it was authentic, and you could tell it was authentic because he was putting the time and effort into thinking that it was important. Okay. And I think there's as a manager, I forget whether it's Brené Brown or somebody, but if somebody was like, at least look the part, okay? And so sometimes you have to fake it till you make it, right? But if you're going to fake it till you make it, fake it on stuff like that. Fake it, in other words, hey,
practice.
I actually care about you as a human being. I actually care about your growth and development. If you can convey that as a manager, boy, you're 100 steps ahead. Because then people will be like, oh yeah, I want to work for this person.
Yeah, that's another, for me, connection to mindfulness is that it requires practice. One of the things I really love about your book is that you have questions in each of your chapters. You spoke earlier about the benefit of having someone come from the outside, a consultant, and noticing things that you've grown accustomed to. And the questions are opportunities for that deeper dive, and you don't answer them. So I'm wondering how you came up with that format and if it was hard not to kind of rush it and say, okay, this is how I would have answered the questions to that case study.
Managing people, one of the reasons it's difficult is that it's not like there's a whole just set of right, wrong answers. It's not like, okay, to get the spaceship off the ground, A has to happen, followed by B, followed by C, followed by D. And each of these things need to happen in sequence, and they all have to happen at this percentage of whatever. No, that's not how it works. Each situation, even the ones that look kind of cut and dry, have many implications. So somebody might come in, for example, and make a vacation request. Okay, that's pretty cut and dry. But if you think about managing in a sense of three-dimensional chess, okay, if I approve that vacation request, what's the impact on the operation? Oh, Sally also asked for that week off. How do I deal with Sally? Oh, this might push the project back another week. How do I deal with the vendor, the customer? Oh, what is the precedent that is set? Oh, it's during a religious holiday. Oh, so you don't want to overcomplicate things as a manager. You want to have things set up so that there's parameters already established. But the point is that these situations typically aren't black and white. The things that come up for managers that really are challenging are almost never black and white. So one of the things as I put case studies out is, do you want to chew on this? Because depending on a whole bunch of other circumstances, this could go this way or this could go that way, right? And so that's the format I use in my management training and consulting, and so I'm simply following that type of format and getting people to talk. Most people who are managers, I mean, you're talking about smart people, right? And they want to chew around these issues. They don't want somebody just handing them something and telling them what to do. They want to kick this around a little bit, They've got some intellectual curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a core coaching principle for many coaching sort of modalities that you have the wisdom within you.
Yes.
You need the time and the space and good yes. questions to help it emerge.
Exactly. And certainly I've got clients now and they're really good executives, really good managers. And hey, they know their operation better than I do. I'm here to ask you the questions. Okay. And one of the great coaching tips given to me when I became a CEO was your job now isn't to tell people what to do. Your job now is to tell people, here's how you might want to be thinking about this, right?
Nice.
And let them find the answers themselves.
Nice. You're listening to On Mindfulness, and I am speaking with Larry Olmsted about his new book, How to Be an Awesome Boss. So there's those questions at each chapter, and then the appendices are super rich. And they have, you know, learning outcomes, there are some warm-up exercises. I mean, it's all set up so people can use it in different ways, one-on-one and staff meetings and whatnot. I imagine many of them are so connected with the book, you know, that they might have been created for the book. But I'm wondering if you have used any of these, either with a client or as an awesome boss, and what were some of your takeaways from the experience, either specific or more general?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Sharon, thanks for referring to what I call what the book calls facilitation guides.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of intentionally wrote this book to be useful and especially to be useful for people who are doing the kind of jobs work I do, being human resources managers, being consultants, working with companies, or being just managers who want to drive these concepts home for other managers or for people they are supervising. And as so I basically set the facilitation guides up as a curriculum for driving home the issues raised in the book. And I'll give you I work in that format a lot as a consultant. And there's a case study in the book, it's called Who Should Go? And it's basically set in a newspaper newsroom, and it's about a manager's decision as to whether to send a young African-American reporter or a young white female reporter into a challenging story assignment in a predominantly black and brown neighborhood. And this case study I wrote years ago and utilized it in seminars at, you know, probably dozens of times, if not more, for organizations like the Associated American Press Institute and different colleges and different newspaper organizations. And the impact of teaching in that way, and again, not giving the answer, because on that one, there really was no one right answer, is what you see. I think the thing that I saw was people saying, I hadn't thought about that. In this particular case, as an example, in this city, of course, this white female reporter should go out into the streets and in broad daylight and deal with the story. I hadn't thought about the safety implication, or how, even if I didn't think there was a safety implication, what's the impact for this individual thinking about the safety implication? Because all of us have a different threshold, right?
Thanks.
Or I didn't think that the African-American reporter might think he's being pigeonholed because I'm sending him to a black assignment. So it wasn't so much, it was unearthing people who had different issues, or they were racist or sexist or this or blind, or were just totally blind to what was going on, or had no judgment. It was like, for all of us, there might be something we're not thinking about, especially in the heat of a moment. And in all companies, all organizations will have that where you have to make a quick decision. What do you lean on in order to make that quick decision? And so it's really about challenging the way you think. And yes, there's no way Larry Olmsted has the capability or would want to have the capability of telling somebody, this is how you should do it in those types of managerial situations. It's more, you've got to lean on your judgment and you've got to lean on the values and mission of your organization.
I can also see how beneficial unearthing the different perspectives on your team could be.
I've had the experience of being a consultant, walking an organization through, and what ground rules would you like to have that will help govern how people deal with each other, how people communicate with each other, so that everything goes smoothly. So then you start saying, okay, well, you have to come back to practice, as you said. You also have to say, what are the mechanisms for accountability, for self-accountability? And then how will the organization respond when you're coming up short? Then people are like, oh, do I call this person out? And now it feels dangerous and uncomfortable to call this person out. So you have to have as an organization or a management team or whomever, you have to really talk through that so that people understand that when you're going off script or off the side of the road here, I've got to pull you back. I'm not pulling you back because I'm being mean and nasty. I'm pulling you back because we've all agreed that this is the kind of organization we want to have, and this is how we want to treat each other and behave. And you as an individual, this is, you talk about mindfulness, you as an individual have to take an honest look in the eye and say, if I'm going to be agreeing to this, I need to self-regulate myself so that, hey, oh, I know, I think I'm starting to veer off the side here. Let mm-hmm. me pull myself back in. Mm-hmm. And some of that is about just being humble enough to apologize if you've made a mistake, being humble enough to admit that. Book gives a really cool case study, which is only too real, unfortunately, about an executive who kind of screws up during the COVID situation and creates a scenario where now you've got distrust in the organization. And that one of it, again, I don't give the answer, but part of the answer for that CEO is going to have to be, I've got to own up to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to be able to tell my people, hey, I didn't quite guide you in the correct way. Here's the course adjustment that we're going to need to make.
I've had my own business for a long time, but worked for some great places, but I worked in one particularly toxic environment. And I was thinking about those questions and I thought, ooh, that would not have worked well or been trusted. So I wonder what you would suggest to people about any kind of prerequisites one might need to take on some of those case studies.
Thanks. That's a great question because I realized after writing the book that sometimes you might guide somebody to do something and it might blow up. So I think that's a fair question. A few things. First of all, prerequisites. One is before you get people into a conversation about workplace environment, you probably want it to be, unless it's management handing down an edict, or it's management in a very careful way setting up a seminar, a webinar, a real professionally processed thing. So first of all, you probably want to make it voluntary, their participation to be voluntary, and you want to set up ground rules. This is, as we do this discussion, first of all, we're not going to have this as part of the conversation. We're not, and so forth and so on. And so that would be, to me, and there's several other ground rules you can set up. But that's to me the most important thing, knowing in advance before you get into the discussion what we're going to agree to talk about and what we're not. Even in an informal discussion, I've seen situations where somebody thought it was a great idea at lunchtime to have a good discussion about some latest things that happened in the LGBTQ environment, and misreading the people who were around the table, and ending up, you know, with an issue, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to be careful about that. You want to use just good judgment and common sense. Anyhow, this may be a little controversial. I think we have a bigger danger in our workplaces of not confronting and not discussing key issues. And by not discussing them, we actually create more of a problem, more of a liability situation than by having these issues discussed openly. So one ground rule, if you're having these kinds of discussions, is to not put on the table anything that might be kind of a personnel jacket kind of item. Juliet's religion or oh, this sounds just like your situation last year where you brought into the workplace where you had a medical condition that blah blah blah, you know. So to me, as long as we can keep it away from things that could end up in a personnel jacket, then we can have this discussion. I mentioned earlier our Haitians eating pets issue. When that came up in the presidential race a couple of years ago, at United Way of Northern California, where a lot of our programs and efforts, of course, involved immigrant communities, and there was a lot of anxiety on the staff, and that whole thing brought me to tears, frankly, as someone who lived in Miami and worked very closely with the Haitian community there. And our decision, as it was on several other occasions, was simply to create an open space for staff to come and share whatever they felt they needed to share. And we didn't have many ground rules, but we basically said this is an open space. If you have an environment where this kind of thing happens, then people aren't put off unnecessarily by it. It was voluntary. People could come. If they didn't come, no problem. People could say what they wanted to say. If they wanted to sit silently, there was no problem. And so when folks understand that that is the motivation, and then as a leader, you do the right things to model the behavior, because it's important. Yeah, people might be a little, you know, shaky here. Let me put myself out there, show my vulnerability, and then other people, you know, will pick it up. So that's that kind of thinking. So I guess what I'm saying in brief is I try not to be afraid or to convey that everybody should be afraid to have what some people might consider a difficult conversation, because most people, if you come at it with a sense of respect and dignity, you know, then you'll be okay. One of the things is people of color and women, you know, this, we're used to, we've got to work with the majority, right? So we actually cut a lot of slack to the majority, right? The majority doesn't always understand that. We're cutting you a lot of slack, right? And so you say something that's kind of tough or that doesn't sound quite the right tone, right? But if your heart is good, if you're overall trying to treat people with respect and dignity, it was a little off, and we'll let that slide, right? You know, so let's err on the side of being open as long as we're doing it in a respectful and inclusive manner.
Mm-hmm. That goes back to the ability of a leader to self-regulate, right? To be able to hear hard feedback and whatnot. And so, you know, kind of bringing it back to you are navigating many things, you know, right now. Before we started, we talked about, so you're not exactly retiring, but you're retiring from a very public career in at United Way, and that more traditional, you're going to have your own business, and also navigating, I say this from people that I love who have had similar experiences, you know, kind of watching United Way go through some hard times after a very successful, you know, leadership there. And all of that requires a lot of mindfulness, ability to self-regulate, openness, curiosity, all of those things. What helps you maintain those postures when there's so many things around you that are difficult to navigate?
Yeah, it's challenging, and I think it's challenging for most people who are managers and leaders. For me, a few principles, and part of this is I was in leadership positions from an early age, so experience really helps. And one of the things I learned about myself at an early age was things that happen in the business realm are business. I try not to take them personally. I found that having that as a thick skin is a pretty good thing to have as a leader or as a manager. If someone is reacting to something that I've said or done or that occurs in the business realm, you know, you understand that this is what happens in business, and we just have to deal with it in that framework. Now, sometimes I have to force myself to be, oh, it's just business. And in fact, a lot of my most important friendships have come out of the business realm. So I know I'm not a robot, but in dealing with any individual situation, that ends up being a pretty good way to look at it. I think anybody in critical leadership roles understands the value of compartmentalizing. I've had a bad day in every other realm, but in this situation, I need to really focus. My example for that was my last 2 days as the managing editor of the Miami Herald. On one of those days, I started out at a memorial service for an employee, one of our best employees who had passed away suddenly. Mm. In the afternoon, I had to preside over the employee of the quarter ceremony involving giving 9 awards to our best employees for the quarter. In the meantime, I had to finish up 3 performance reviews, and I had to all do this while I was getting ready to exit the organization. And so that I always remind myself I had the ability to compartmentalize when I had to do it. And that's a good thing to do. Sometimes you want to remember that you are a human being. You know, have to work that into the equation. And I think for me, the other thing is just understanding, what am I trying to accomplish as a human being and as a manager? Understanding those is critical. And if you don't know in the workplace what you're trying to accomplish, then of course your people who are working with you don't know that either. And the people who are working for you don't know that. So what is the goal? What is my goal? What is my mission? I was sharing with you before we came on, I just spent a week in San Diego kind of relaxing after the difficult sequence of things in my life. And a lot of that time was spent answering that question for myself. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of how I try to, you know, regulate all of that for myself.
Yeah. Back to that intentionality, that why or purpose.
Absolutely.
Well, Larry, we've spoken about a lot. as we come to the end, is there anything else that we should have spoken about or that you feel is left unsaid or that you'd like to share?
Well, one nuts and bolts thing about my book, it is about to go on sale. In fact, I'm getting a shipment of another pre-shipment today of my the hardcover version of my book. So it will be on Amazon and Book Baby, my publisher. They have a distribution arm, and hopefully in many other places. In the meantime, if anyone is interested in getting a book, $16.99, and they can you can just start for now by emailing me at Larry@leadwithlarry.com. Larry@leadwithlarry.com. And the other thing that I would say is totally appreciate your linking this topic to mindfulness. It is undoubtedly the core of what I've seen and experienced as a manager and as a leader. It is baffling to me sometimes how much people underestimate, managers and leaders underestimate the importance of supervising people well. And just because sometimes your skill at supervising people, most of the times, is not going to be what gets you into those roles or promoted, but it is generally the thing that takes you down as a manager. Most managers fail because they come in with the operational skills they need, but they don't have the people skills they need. And so they are hiring the wrong person, supervising them in a way in which those people aren't getting the job done. The people are turning on them. They've created communications issues in their organizations or they just flat out, this person messed you up. They stole, they did this, they did that, because you haven't paid enough attention to actually supervising them and well. And on the flip side, if you do a great job supervising them, they will run through the wall for you. Mm-hmm. And they will take you to levels of achievement that you wouldn't have dreamed were possible.
That's a great place to end. And I recommend we'll put links to how to buy Larry's book in the archived version of this show on kkrn.org. Definitely worth a read. I loved it. I am getting some copies to share with people in different leadership positions, and I hope you do the same. This is On Mindfulness on KKRN Community Supported Radio. Thank you for listening. To On Mindfulness on KKRN, Community Supported Radio. Our theme music is provided by Rachel Beck of Omnificent.
Don't you want me always to say, oh, life? Life's been